What is the next phase in Florida's use of medical marijuana? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen to us anytime or on iTunes, and stream the show live right now on our Facebook page. Just ahead, why calls are growing for a special session on medical marijuana. Then later, a look at what's next in the case against Corrine Brown after she is convicted on 18 of 22 federal counts. Plus, Culpepper and an historic Players' Championship. All of that and more ahead. In just a few minutes, we'll take a look at growing calls for a special session here in Florida on medical marijuana. That's in just a few moments. But first, former Jacksonville Congresswoman Corrine Brown is now a convicted felon. Last week, a jury returned guilty verdicts on 18 of 22 federal counts against Brown related to a bogus charity, One Door for Education. It was high drama at the downtown courthouse as the verdicts came back from the jury. But what can we expect in terms of Brown's sentence? It could actually be a long time before her fate in the legal system is set. Jacksonville attorney John Phillips has been following this and joins us now in studio with his thoughts. Hey, John, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
And to our callers, what do you think is a fair sentence in the conviction of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown? 549-2937 to give us a call. So Corrine Brown is now convicted on 18 of 22 counts, but she can appeal. There could be a new trial. What can we expect, John?
With situation like this, the first thing they do is we've got to get past sentencing. And then the Judge Corrigan will decide a general sentence, which we can get into. And then around that time, the motion for a new trial will be filed. Mm-hmm. The judge will look at it, look at the issue, particularly with the juror that was replaced, I think is going to be a major issue. Depending upon the ruling with the motion for new trial, then there would be an appeal, which would go to the 11th Circuit in Atlanta.
Let's talk about that 11th hour replacement of the juror. What could that? What effect could that have?
I think, and I didn't sit in trial every day, and it's hard to armchair quarterback one of these things, but that's one of those interesting points. And they also had a lot of the conversations in private. And so they're going to have to look at the transcripts to see why Judge Corrigan felt it was appropriate to replace this juror. But basically, if you read the media reports, the juror was pretty convinced that she was going to find Congresswoman or former Congresswoman Brown not guilty on all charges. Uh-huh. And so you would have had a hung jury had this person sat and been consistent with what the media reports say.
There was some conjecture we could have a hung jury. It didn't happen, though.
Exactly. And so if you had one person out of the full panel that was going the other way, and you know, it's kind of that 12 angry men, play.
Yeah.
You had one person that wouldn't be otherwise convinced, then we'd be facing a new trial instead of the conviction on 18 out of 22.
Now, it's fascinating to learn that Judge Timothy Corrigan has wide latitude as he hands down a sentence. He could look at a lot of mitigating factors like the Congresswoman's age, her decades of public service, all the character witnesses that spoke up on her behalf. Now, will those make a difference in sentencing? What do you think about those who are sort of predicting that Brown won't even see any jail time?
I didn't necessarily agree that she was going to get home confinement or there wouldn't be jail time. The jury here did have a mandate. 18 out of 22 is significant. And so I feel like Judge Corrigan will take that into effect, but there's a difference between state court and federal court, right? Mm-hmm. In state law, there are minimum mandatories and there's less discretion on state court judges. These federal judges, once appointed, get wide discretion. And so they can up or down. The 347 or whatever the number of years that was talked about pretrial that she was facing, that was if all of them ran consecutive, mm-hmm. which never happens. They usually run them concurrent, meaning at the same time. But there's a possibility of a 5 to 15 year sentence in there with some of it suspended for home confinement.
So in the end, you, John Phillips, if you had to make a prediction, what would you say? What amount of time will Corrine Brown actually do?
It's tough. And it's tough on me because I worked with the Congresswoman at the time on the Jordan Davis case. And so she's been a good acquaintance through this, and I hate it for her. But you do the crime, you do the time. all of that disclaimer aside, let me answer your question. That I think that 5 to 10 range, you know, even at 70 years old, is possible, with some of it possibly suspended for home confinement.
Wow. Okay, let's go to some calls on this at 549-2937. And then in a moment, we're going to talk about what looks to be a special session in Florida on medical marijuana. We'll take your calls on that in just a few minutes. But first, Richard in Mandarin. Go ahead, Richard.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to express the humble opinion of a citizen here. Where does all this money come from? Where does the legal proceedings money come from, and also the defense money come from? You know, because all this has got to be funded somehow. And not only are, at this point, we allegedly been defrauded, now we have to fund this whole project as well, as a taxpayer. It's like, give us a break. I mean, now we're in for a double dip here, it sounds like. And is that being considered, you know, from a legal standpoint? I'm sure it is, but you know, come on.
Thanks, Richard.
Federal prosecutors will tell you that they're going to prosecute no matter the cost. They look at it some, they have budgets, but for the most part, the critique that there was more money spent prosecuting this than probably was taken from the donor class or not given to the one door recipients who may not have ever existed, you know, is not how they look at it. They want to put people away for breaching the public trust, particularly those in leadership positions. So as far as the prosecution money, it does come from taxpayers. The defense money, I assume Mr. Smith mm-hmm. reduced his fee in this instance, but you know, that would be between him and Ms. Brown.
Chuck at the Beaches. Hello, Chuck.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, good morning.
My question is along this line. She's an older woman. Okay, so I, as a taxpayer, why do I want to spend our money to put this woman in prison when we might be able to, and the goal would be to deter other politicians and other people from doing the same thing? So how could and what could we do short of putting her in jail for 3 months, putting her on probation, giving her community service, and making it very clear to her and other people that this is not allowed, but at the same time not spend a bunch of our money to put someone in prison, which I don't see that doing any good at all. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Chuck.
The question of to throw the book or not throw the book.
Yeah.
And which one deters? And
let me just jump in. Is it the fact that it's a 70-year-old woman rather than a 70-year-old guy? Do you think that that is playing on some people's sympathy in this situation?
I think it is. And again, if you've done the crime, you know, that's a significant issue. But former Congresswoman Brown did a lot of good here, too. And the line that she helped that courthouse, you know, the irony that she helped that courthouse be built and funded is significant. But to deter it, and it's rampant. There's a lot of this that goes on. There was a 60 Minutes or 2020 special about a governor's race, and the governor was taking, and that it was actually legal to go on some of these trips. And you know, you really need it to be a deterrent. That's one of the purposes of the criminal justice system, not just to punish, but to deter. And hopefully it works. It may not. They may be in such an entitled leadership position that it doesn't.
Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Yes, I'm not sure about the legalities of it, but I think what would be fair in this case is if she was just stripped of her pension and told to go about her life.
Thanks for that.
That's coming regardless.
There's
federal legislation that essentially mandates certain felonies that are once you're convicted, that the pension goes away. So that, and a lot of people don't understand all the stuff. Why does it take 90 days to get sentenced? There are pre-sentencing reports. There's research that's done. There's sometimes psychological studies. I mean, you look at health, you look at everything to try to let the punishment fit the crime and the person who committed the crime. And Judge Corrigan will have a sentencing report that talks about the pension that's going to go away too, because she's got $500,000 or so in fines that are on top of this. I mean, on top of
that's
losing
significant.
The pension,
yeah.
It is significant.
Okay, so what's the next move on the board here from her defense and then Judge Corrigan?
From her defense, it's kind of tried to remediate and have the pre-sentencing reports as favorable as possible to keep that sentence as small as possible so that your worst case scenario is as good as it can get. The prosecution wants to do the opposite, and you've seen it in their press releases so far. We've got to stop this, and punishment. And so they're going to, again, go to the opposite advocacy role of this is something that isn't just about former Congresswoman Brown. It's about the system in general. And so that you'll see a lot of that geared up for the sentencing report and the sentencing hearing in 90 days to 120 days. And then it's going to be about the appeal, which could take a year or two. The 11th Circuit is often backed up.
Right. This could drag on for some time.
It could be. And it's 70 years old. We saw it with Howard Schneider's case because we handled the victims in Howard Schneider.
That was the pediatric dentist who was abusing children. You prosecuted him.
We represented 104 of the families. And they felt they were deprived justice some because the clock ticked out to the point that he was found incompetent and now can't serve criminal time, at least at this juncture. And you may see that.
Could they go for that sort of defense?
You could. Right now, she's plenty competent. I mean, she's super competent. But once you're stripped of everything that makes you tick, you see people's health go down pretty quick. And we saw it with Schneider. And you know, it's not going to be an easy road, losing all of your assets, losing, you know, essentially your legacy. She was constantly talking about, you know, she had a birth certificate and a death certificate and was defined by that dash. And the end of that dash is looking pretty.
It's a sad story.
It really is.
It truly is.
It really is.
All right. John on the South Side. Go ahead, John.
Good morning. And thank you for taking my call. You know, it is a sad scenario all around, but at the same time, you know, there was adjudication, you know, by federal jurisdiction. And going forward, not only for Corinne Brown, but for everyone else, you know, have booking day. In other words, just, you know, have that day where, you know, you come in and if it turns out to be home arrest, you know, it can be transferred that way. But get the prosecutors, the defenders in there. And we do it with the NFL for retirees. You know, just a suggestion.
Thanks, John. Cynthia in Springfield. Hello, Cynthia.
Hi. I personally think that they should definitely sell off all of her assets to pay back this fund, as well as restitution for the fees that we've had to pay for, you know, the prosecutor's legal fees. And I just think that, you know, I don't care how old she is. I don't care that she is a woman. I mean, you do the time, you do the crime, you do the time. And I think it's just, I'm just kind of sick of it, quite frankly.
All right.
It seems like people always get over on us with these types of crimes. It's just, nothing's happening to them.
Thanks, Cynthia.
There's always the chance for a plea where the two sides work out some extended deal, but it seems to me from the stance the DOJ and the FBI that they are doing exactly what that caller wished.
Lots of calls on this. Andy in St. Augustine. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, and it's a beautiful day here in St. Augustine.
Good.
Thank you for all your good work.
Thanks.
My question is regarding Attorney General Sessions' mandate to all federal prosecutors to follow the fullest extent of criminal penalties. How do you think that will affect this case? And I'll be happy to hear your reply.
Okay.
Off the air.
Thanks, Andy.
That mandate essentially was a charging mandate. I think even before that charging mandate came out that Ms. Brown was charged with everything that they thought they could prove. It's what we're afraid of as criminal defense lawyers, because my firm does that mandate is going to really affect is the overcrowding position, like really going after drug crimes, white collar crimes. The government tends to aggressively pursue,
and they very convincingly laid out an overwhelming trail of evidence in this case, didn't they?
They did, and that's why you see a 90-some-odd% conviction rate in federal court, because they're ready. They go after – it's not like state court where they have a DUI. You know, how many DUIs do you try every week? And you win some, you lose some. But there, you know, it's not as much of a revolving door when you're dealing with severe white-collar crime.
Sue is in Mandarin. Go ahead, Sue.
You got to stop talking about her age. That drives me crazy. I'm 77 and still getting around doing a lot during my day. She's not infirm. She's a very vital lady who does a lot. So she's not an old, decrepit person who's looking at winding up in a rocking chair, not for some years. This lady's got a lot of go, so stop talking about it as if she's a frail, elderly, poor soul.
I saw her dancing at Jordan Davis Day a couple years ago, and she outdanced me. So it's true. She's very vibrant. She's very with it. And you'd hope that she'd get the chance if, you know, after this to use that for good, so to speak. But again, you get convicted of mm-hmm. 18 felonies, you pay the piper.
Even if it's just a year or two, it sounds as though you think that's likely.
I really do. I'm torn with this because you've got children victims essentially. And yet I posted over the weekend or Friday when some of this was coming out that we are often judged by our worst days, and that's just the way it works. And so all the good, all the good points, karma points, whatever you want to refer to them that you've built up, if you've done something bad, that's what people remember.
Speaking of all of the far-reaching tentacles of this, here's an email from Ricardo. Any indication that her donors will be looked at? Did they know the charity was fake and the money was actually a bribe? Some high-powered people donated money, household names in this community, and it later was revealed that the money went to fund Congresswoman Brown's lifestyle, not help children.
Right. And I don't think they'll ever be prosecuted because they got up and testified about it, frankly. But it's... We're in a country where people put leaders in boxes and suites and take them out and you know, publicly endorse. And there's a lot of quid pro quo that goes on every single day.
Isn't that the larger thing that's been revealed in this trial? Just how willingly people are willing to stroke a check for any kind of access to a sitting member of Congress?
Without
batting an eye, with no due diligence.
And it's the last 5 years, my firm's grown from 2 people to 16 people, 17 people. And I've seen it. You know, people are more inclined to say, call me up that used to not call me up for an endorsement. And it's
at the very least, they're laughing really hard at all your jokes, aren't they?
Right. And so it's
they never used to somehow.
And so it's
I've had that experience myself.
Exactly. And so it's you know, we're just in that society, and the more entitlement you have, the more power you have. It's that absolute power corrupts absolutely. The harder it is to say no, and the not the average Joe, because I hate to call anybody average, but the person on the street out there is like, well, nobody's taking me to the Beyonce concert and giving me shrimp cocktail, and so yeah. it stings.
Yeah.
For them to work, for the average person to work so hard, and this person supposedly to be of those people to be taking advantage. But it happens all too often.
Linda is in Bay Meadows. Go ahead, Linda. You're on the air.
Yes. The question I just wanted to ask is there any consideration, do you think, on appeal for the juror that was dismissed and why that wasn't a mistrial? Because as soon as that juror... left, the verdict came in, and I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on that?
Okay.
Fantastic question, and I think that's going to be the question that's debated over the next 6 months to a year as to what that juror said. That juror was probably interviewed by the judge and the attorneys privately, and if that juror said, I plan to acquit. I plan to say not guilty, regardless of the evidence, because of a dream or because, of some issue besides the direct look at the evidence, then that juror was subject to removal. And that's within Judge Corrigan's discretion. And that would probably be the stance of the federal prosecutors. If that person said, I will listen to the evidence, but I'm leaning towards acquittal, that would be a different circumstance and you wouldn't remove it. But it's mm-hmm. they obviously heard something that they thought that there was a problem.
Well, there may yet be a few twists and turns. In the meantime, we thank you, as always, for your legal expertise. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
He's Jacksonville criminal defense attorney John Phillips. Much more still ahead later. Culpepper on the finale out at the Players Championship. Also Health Design CEO Ann Sebag. But right after this, why we could soon be seeing a special session in Florida when it comes to medical marijuana. That's in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Next time on 1A, speaking with a single voice. When the White House says something, America and the world take note. But the president says, with so much going on, we just can't expect his spokespeople to be on the same page. So whom do we believe? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On WJCT's radio reading service at 8 a.m. weekday mornings, it's 3 hours of news, op-eds, and obituaries from your local newspaper. Here's a call we received from someone who listens online.
I'm very happy to tell you that my daughter found the app for the radio reading service on my tablet, and I'm using that, and it's excellent. I enjoy all the programs.
If you're living with blindness and want to hear what's in the paper, go to wjct.org/radio reading, underwritten by Florida Eye Specialists.
Join WJCT for Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, June 3rd from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the WJCT studios. The day will include family-friendly activities, PBS Kids characters, food trucks, and so much more. The event is free, but reservations are required. For more information, log on to wjct.org/events.
Welcome back. Well, growing calls for a special session here in Florida on medical marijuana. Lawmakers ended their legislative session last week in Tallahassee without any real agreement on how to implement a voter-approved constitutional amendment that broadly legalized medical marijuana here in the state. Now, one major sticking point was figuring out just how many retail outlets medical marijuana operators in Florida should be able to run. The slow pace of implementation has frustrated patients all over Florida who want wider access to THC or cannabis to treat their various ailments. So what could we expect from a special session on medical marijuana, and how have other states dealt with this issue? Attorney David Feuerstein is a partner at DFMK Law, and he leads a team with experience in virtually all legal and business aspects of the emerging cannabis industry. And he's on the line this morning from New York City. David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. How important is it to you that the legislature hold a special session on wider implementation of medical marijuana in Florida? What do you think about this? Give us a call at 549-2937. Now, David, the legislative session ended with no resolution on this, even though voters approved a constitutional amendment by about 70%. And the sticking point is how many dispensaries, honestly, there should be around the state. How many retail outlets can sell this product? As an attorney who has seen this unroll in state after state, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think I certainly understand both sides of the argument. On the one hand, the Senate wants to limit the number of dispensaries that can be set up or established in the immediate term, and argues in support of that, that it creates lesser barriers of entry and certainly, you know, keeps neighborhoods, quote unquote, in intact without having dispensaries pop up all over the place. You know, on the other hand, I can understand the sort of idea of a free market from the house's side, and frankly, I wish there was a magic formula that I could recommend for the Florida legislature to implement. Unfortunately, there is none, and it is, you know, each state has its own agenda in order to how to implement and roll out a robust medical program.
And what are some examples you could point to? Obviously, a few states have fully legalized all forms of marijuana, like Colorado. Other states have just gone part of the way, as Florida has, with medical-only legalization. What sort of examples have you observed as you look at this in the macro on how other states have dealt with these issues? For example, right now, the rollout of the amendment is in the hands of the Florida Department of Health. That doesn't look to be a long-term solution.
Well, let me take your first point. Your first point first, and then I'll get to the Department of Health. The almost every state has rolled out, and I think every state has rolled out a medical program prior to a recreational program. So, in states such as Oregon, Massachusetts, they had an established medical program first. And then we're rolling, and then had either an amendment or a voter approval of a recreational program, and then had to roll out a recreational program. So, most states, and it's not all states, start with the medical program. And excuse me, typically you're going to limit in some form the number of dispensaries that are going to be created, because there's all sorts of things that you can't expect, right? I mean, a lot of towns will have zoning regulations. From a statewide level, there is some merit to the point of what the Senate is saying, in that you certainly do not want to create this overwhelming amount of dispensaries such that new movers to the market will never have an ability to enter the market. I mean, that's a general, sort of monopoly or oligopoly law. With respect to the Department of Health coming in, it really depends on the sort of guidance the Department of Health is ultimately getting from the legislature. But the Department of Health is the Department of Health for a reason, and it has a single focus of the health of its constituents or the constituents in Florida. So it's not a horrible thing to have an administrative agency promulgating regulations. In fact, that's what they do. I understand that, the Department of Health had issues previously with respect to marijuana laws and the implementation of marijuana laws, but that's not a recipe that will happen again. Now, having said that, I think from what I've read and observed, the Department of Health proposed regulations are fairly restrictive and may not really be honoring the will of the voters. And that is an issue.
Let me ask you, as a follow-up to another wrinkle, John Morgan, he is a familiar face to many Floridians. He's an Orlando trial lawyer who's thinking about running for governor. He's on TV with his commercials pretty much at all hours of the day, and on radio too, and on billboards. And he became the face of Amendment 2 in the state. He's now pledging to sue the state over whether patients should be allowed to smoke the marijuana treatment. He's arguing that that is within the constitutional amendment. That is another sticking point, whether how this drug will be ingested.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely an issue. I believe it was Senator Bradley who said that it was his view and some of his colleagues' view that smoking is not consistent with consuming medicine. But studies, I believe, have shown that, or at least anecdotal studies have shown, that sometimes the only relief that patients are able to obtain is through smoking the flower. And so from that perspective, you know, I think it is a little bit of an over-restriction on patients to say that they're only going to administer it in certain ways. But again, that's not an unusual step in a state that's just really beginning its medical program. New York is very highly restrictive a state in the manner in which you can consume or ingest cannabis. And so, and that's, again, that's not an unusual thing. I do think that there is merit to the anecdotal stories, which are many, that relief can sometimes only be found through smoking marijuana. I'll say sort of as an aside, I heard on a radio show here in New York that there was a New York state judge who was suffering from, I believe it was cancer, and he advocating for legalized medical marijuana, said that the only way he was able to get relief was to go to another state to find the flower and able to ingest the flower or through smoking.
All right, let's take a few calls on this, if I could. 549-2937. Margaret in San Marco. Margaret, good morning.
Hey, good morning. It's just Margaret.
Oh, Margaret. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I would like to see the implementation of this law delayed and then limited as much as possible. I ride the city bus, and I remember shortly before this passed into law, overhearing a gentleman behind me loudly laughing and boasting that pretty soon the government was going to be paying for his weed. And I think that if this, the concept of medical necessity here is construed too loosely, then anyone who claims anxiety or stress or any kind of unprovable mental disorder or discomfort and knows the right doctor to go to can get a prescription and get his health care plan or the government or whatever to pay for it. It's going to be almost worse than recreational marijuana where the people pay for it individually, but it's going to be all the benefits of recreational marijuana for the users at somebody else's expense.
Thanks, Margaret. David.
Listen, Margaret, I think your concerns are obviously valid concerns, and what I would tell, you know, sort of constituents of Florida who share those concerns is there are ways to curtail those potential abuses, but 70% of the state has voted in favor of a program that's going to have more robust medical marijuana in that state. And we live in a democracy, and that democracy, you know, should be honored. And while I agree that people ought to take careful steps while rolling this out, there's also obligations you have to the voters and the constituents. So you have to sort of balance the two. And it's not an easy job. It's not an enviable job, but it is their job to do.
Cameron is in St. Augustine. Hello, Cameron. You're on the air.
Hi there. How you doing, guys? Thanks
Good.
For having me on. I wanted to comment that I've seen, you know, the benefits of it when it comes to not even just the THC part, but the CBDs, I travel to British Columbia about every year or so, and up there, it's a totally different mindset. And the guy who created Rick Simpson Oils, I believe it is, they have no way of getting you, you know, high in any way, but they have huge medical benefits, and it's another part of the plant that is, you know, just starting to get studies on. And I think the more we bring it into the light, the more studies we do, the more we'll find out the medical benefits. And as long as we don't keep it in the dark anymore, we, you know, have a good future to look forward to as all. So
thanks, Cameron. James,
that's an excellent.
Go ahead. Go ahead, David.
That's an excellent point, Cameron. You know, people, when they think of cannabis, they think of the THC or the psychedelic component of it all the time. But really, there are, I can't remember the number, but I'll throw out the number, over 100 CBD or cannabinoids in the marijuana plant, many of which have health benefits. And many of the health benefits that people are advocating are in the CBD, not the THC. And so that's an important, very important point to remember in talking about getting things rolled out and getting them implemented, because there's many aspects of this that have nothing to do with people having a THC effect, but enjoying the benefits of the CBDs.
All right, now let's go to James. James in Fernandina. Hello, James. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning. How are you?
Okay, go ahead.
Well,
I just wondered from an enforcement standpoint. I know obviously all of our police jurisdictions and officers in the field have ways of measuring intoxication levels and what alcohol levels and that kind of thing. Is that something that will be rolled out simultaneously as a way to measure intoxication or impact from marijuana use? Or if not, is that up to each department to come up with a way to do that and to pay for it? How will that be handled?
Okay. Thanks for that. Great question.
So, as far as I know, there's still not technology that allows for sort of a roadside administration of a THC or intoxication level. So you're not going to be able to measure somebody's THC intake at the side of the road the same way you could with alcohol. I think if you could create that, you'd be a very wealthy man, James. But it, quite frankly, that's one of the issues, I think, that's actually slowing the rollout of medical marijuana throughout the country. I think that's a federal issue. It's certainly a state issue, I should say, but I think it's a concern at the federal level and why the federal government has not gotten more on board with this program.
In the meantime, though, David, Florida, one of the biggest states in the country, it is seen as an incredibly lucrative market around the country, isn't it, when it comes to this product? Here's a tweet from Adam. I don't believe marijuana dispensaries will ever outnumber liquor stores, cigarette depots, and adult novelty stores in this state, but free market dictates the number in the end. How will the market forces work, do you think, as this continues to roll out?
Well, I think that I am a proponent of capitalism. I think that absent state-granted oligopoly or regulations, that it would, you know, the free market would satisfy the demand of the people, right? So if the people wanted more and more dispensaries, and those more and more dispensaries would ultimately come online. But it's important to remember, again, that cannabis is a very, very plant in the sense that it has both a recreational side, like alcohol, cigarettes, if you will, but it has a medical side to it as well. And the trick in all of this is balancing the two when states decide, really, this is not Florida's issue yet, but ultimately maybe, which is when a state goes from a medical-only state to a medical and recreational state. Because then you're dealing on both sides of the equation, and the question is, how does the state maintain its medical grip, I guess, on the dispensing of cannabis, and then how does it deal with the recreational portion?
As we continue to follow this, we hope you'll join us again on the program and give us your insights. We really appreciate it.
We'll be happy to. Thanks for having me.
He's attorney David Feuerstein, partner at DFMK Law in New York, a legal team with experience in all the legal and business aspects of the emerging cannabis industry. And in a moment, Ann Sebag, founder and CEO of Ponte Vedra's Own Health Design. Stay with us.
On the next Fresh Air...
I got a place. Turns out a place that needs some robin. A little robin, not wholesale burglary, just looking for a certain item.
The FX series Fargo is back for a third season with more murder and mishap. We talk with series creator and writer Noah Hawley. He also created the FX series Legion and has a best-selling novel. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Would you like to influence history? I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Senator Bob Graham and attorney Chris Hand, who offer practical advice about creating positive social change in their new book, America, the Owner's Manual, You Can Fight City Hall and Win. We'll discuss an 1860 libel case and Civil War monuments. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, it's a local firm and an industry leader in workplace wellness. And now, Health Designs has been honored once again as one of the top 50 women-led companies in Florida. Health Designs founder and CEO Ann Sebag is here now with more about her track record of amazing success and also the future of workplace wellness in America. Ann, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's so good to see you. And the Commonwealth Institute of South Florida is honoring your company once again as one of the most influential and trend-setting companies in the country. So first off, congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm very grateful.
And what is Health Designs doing to get this kind of recognition year after year?
I think it's our growth, our sustainability over 21 years, our leadership, and impact in the lives of people that we touch at workplaces, and then the companies in general, because they're healthier, they have a better culture, and they're more productive.
And workplace wellness has become such a buzzword in corporate America. Increasingly, Fortune 500 companies are turning to corporations like yours for solutions. What are some of the solutions you offer companies that are really making this more of a priority?
Well, we help companies understand that the impact that they have on people's lives impact productivity. Sometimes years ago, employers used to keep personal lives separate, but now they're truly intertwined. If people are going to bring their best selves to work, their full selves need to come to work. So when companies recognize that their health and well-being has an impact on productivity, companies benefit. They have higher performing teams. There's better creativity, problem solving, innovation. Mm-hmm. Companies realize that people bring their full and whole selves to work, not just their work selves.
Right. And in addition to being knowledgeable about this and being part of such a burgeoning industry, we have to brag about you a little bit. You were named Florida's Small Business Person of the Year. That's pretty amazing. Got a lot
you.
Of competition out there.
Thank you. A lot of competition.
And what do you think it is about your business that made it stand out so much?
I think it's our mission to provide a lot of common good for the people that we touch, the individuals, the employees that we touch at the workplace, and also the impact that we have on U.S. businesses. I mean, businesses are the economic engine in our country, and if we can make those stronger, more profitable, more competitive, higher performing, then there's a lot of good in the world. And I feel very honored and grateful for the impact that we're making on our companies, as well as the individual lives of people that we touch every day.
Now, you'll be going down to South Florida later this week to pick up your latest accolade, the big awards ceremony, right?
Yes, I'm so excited. I've never gone to the actual ceremony, so I'm glad to be there in person.
I hope you're coming back with some serious hardware. That's always key at these types of events, right? You want the actual hardware. I hope that's what they're giving you.
I'll take a picture and send it to you, Melissa.
Well, it's a thrill to know you, and you're getting such statewide recognition right here out of Ponte Vedra, so Ann Sebag, we salute you, and thanks so much.
And one last thing, I just want to thank the Jacksonville community. As a business owner, a small entrepreneur, especially 21 years ago when no one was doing this, I got a lot of support from mentors, from the Chamber, from Vistage, and every company that I called on was so helpful. So thank you, Jacksonville.
And thank you, Ann Sebag, founder and CEO of the Ponte Vedra-based Health Designs. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Well, finally this hour, it was an historic, if not an overly dramatic, Players Championship.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper with the results from TPC Sawgrass and the rest of the weekend's news and notes and sports. Hey, Cole, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It was 21-year-old South Korean Siwoo Kim who became the youngest ever winner of the Players' Championship, thanks to a bogey-free final round 69 to finish a 10-under par that was three strokes better than England's Ian Poulter and South Africa's Louis Oosthuizen. Kim was steady, if not spectacular, on a day when some of the world's best golfers struggled to score. Former champion Sergio Garcia shot 78 yesterday. So did another former champion, Martin Keimer. Defending champion Jason Day shot 80. And J.B. Holmes, who at one point had the lead on Sunday, shot 84 on the final day. You could say that the toughest competitor over the weekend was the course itself. One reason why some players referenced for the difficult playing conditions was the wind, which was fairly strong yesterday. But it was more the direction than the strength of the wind that gave a lot of golfers trouble. With it coming out of the north, it's the kind of wind we might expect to see in March, not May. And there is a better than just good chance that the tournament will move back to March after a decade playing in May.
Going back to March next year, what's...
Not next year, could probably 2019 most likely would
and
be the
why?
First year for that. Well, one of the things that the tour is trying to do is get the end-of-the-year playoff away from football season because it gets buried. And so if they can get that to August, move everything up a bit, it condenses the schedule fairly substantially. And that would necessitate a move of the U.S. Open and would also necessitate a move of the PGA Championship. And it's sort of a domino effect. And,
yeah.
and they want the players
on the board there. Okay.
Yeah, they want the players to be in a high profile area.
Interesting. Well, speaking of football, some news from the Jaguars clubhouse as
well. They had the rookie minicamp over the weekend. A couple of notes there. Both first round pick Leonard Fournette and second round pick Cam Robinson told me that they want to change the Jaguars culture. These are two guys who certainly had great success in college. Robinson in particular, 3 years at Alabama, only lost four games. The Jaguars lost four games in a month last year, so they want to make a big change there. Part of what we're seeing with Doug Marrone as the head coach is he's really trying to identify where those top players are right now. They have a big group of rookies who are in for the weekend, and then they get ready for the OTAs, the organized team activities, off-season practices shortly. One of the guys who we don't know if he'll be there is Brandon Albert, who was traded from Miami, expected to be the starting left tackle. But he says he wants a new contract, and he's now not been communicating with the Jaguars at all. A clearly frustrated Marrone said on Saturday that he just wants to know what's up, whether he's going to be in, whether he's not, what's going to happen. He hasn't heard from him at all. Huh. So for the time being, it's the second-round pick Cam Robinson who's going to be installed as the first-team left tackle for the time being. One other note. Doug Marrone said that he thought that what he had seen out of Blake Bortles so far this offseason has been a real improvement from his mechanics standpoint. Now, a lot has to go in going forward in terms of the impact on his play, but certainly Bortles appears to have worked on his throwing mechanics.
All right. The Armada, meanwhile, lost over the weekend, the first time in their season this year.
Not just the first time in the season, was it the first time even going back to the preseason? Remember, they didn't lose in the preseason. They lost 3-1 in North Carolina. To North Carolina FC. It's the start of a busy week for the club, who travels to Miami to face Miami United in a U.S. Open Cup match on Wednesday. Then they go cross-country to face the San Francisco Deltas on Friday. After the weekend results, the Armada went from second place in the league to fifth.
Oh,
so a win against San Francisco on Friday could do a lot to help boost them back up the standings.
Meanwhile, the Jumbo Shrimp and the Sharks both pretty much on a roll.
Yeah, the Jumbo Shrimp won 3-1 in Mobile yesterday. They continue the series in Alabama. They'll be back home to start a series on Thursday. While the Sharks were off this week, they sit undefeated, 7-0. They host Monterey Steel Saturday night at the arena.
That's a
there's
good name.
There's a good chance the Sharks could go undefeated throughout this season. A couple of reasons. Number one, I think they have the best team in the league. And number two, there are a lot of teams in this league that are first-year teams really trying to get their feet underneath them. The Sharks are an established franchise who know what they're doing. There's a chance we could be looking at an undefeated Jacksonville Sharks team this year.
Wow, that's exciting. Now, one more sports note that we must take note of. You can't see Cole on the radio, but loyal viewers over at our news partner Channel 4 have probably caught Cole on the air from time to time, and also when he's called the Armada broadcast over on the CW. Cole, it's the end of an era, because last week you did something that none of us ever thought would happen. You shaved off your beard.
Yeah, and maybe 15 years, I've been told. I don't know which 15 years. If that's at the end, we're in big trouble.
Oh, what's been the reaction so far?
There has been a lot of reaction, including my own. I stepped out of the car the other day and caught my reflection in a window and wondered what that guy was doing staring at me.
I really don't.
So Hurricane Floyd in 1999.
That was the last time you went clean shaven?
Well, I was. That was when I started growing.
That was when you started the beard?
Yeah, yeah. And so it was part of a wall-to-wall radio coverage on a former radio station I used to work for. And I, you know, just it was such a slow-moving storm. It took a while. And I finally said, what the heck? Let's grow some out. So I did. And I neither had a goatee or a full beard.
That's almost
since
20
then,
years
with the exception,
facial hair.
Yeah, with the exception of like 1 week that I shaved it off and immediately went back to it. So, yeah, it's taken a little getting used to, both physically. I was out at the Players' Championship covering the tournament this week and was very diligent about making sure to put lots of sunblock on the beard area because
good
it hadn't
thinking.
Seen the light of day for quite some time.
Did people do double takes when they saw you?
Some did. There have been a few who have not even noticed initially. And there are others who I've seen, you know, very regularly who walk right past me, didn't even know it was me. So easier to go incognito in a hat and sunglasses without the beard now.
He is a new man with a new look. The now clean-shaven Cole. Every Monday on this program, always a delight to see you. And follow Cole on Twitter, at Cole Pepper, for all your sports news and notes. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
My husband uses Gillette, by the way. I don't know what you use.
I'm going to have to get some advice because I haven't used one in a while.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs our board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.